7 Summit Snacks. Fuel your next adventure with chocolate crafted to conquer. Made with ethically sourced chocolates and ingredients you know and understand. Find your next taste adventure at 7summitsnacks.com.
Welcome to Northern Latitudes. I'm Bill Ault. Corey is the Director of Bat Conservation for the Wildlife Conservation Society of Canada. 2007, both her master's and PhD research were on bats, with the former focusing on behavior and physiology, and the latter on landscape genetics.
I'm Corey Lawson. I'm the Director of Bat Conservation with Wildlife Conservation Society Canada.
Welcome to Northern Latitudes, Corey.
Thank you.
Corey, you grew up in Alberta, I believe somewhere south of Calgary, if I've done my research correctly.
Pretty close, yeah. A little bit east.
So you went to University of Alberta. How did all of this end up, you were winding up studying bats?
Well, you know, it's funny because I spent a lot of time at the University of Alberta doing genetics. Like, I was not a lab person per se, but somehow I ended up doing a lot of lab work for my PhD, running the genetics of three of the species of bats in the prairies. Technically, I did all of that as a University of Calgary student, believe it or not. I understand. You would have shown some U of A connection there, but actually, University of Calgary, that's where the bat lab was. And so, interestingly enough, I was a University of Calgary undergraduate working on a teaching degree and heading off to teach high school when I had a professor ask me if I wanted to work for him for the summer doing some research. And honestly, research, I didn't even know there was a career in that or that that was even really a thing at that time. So I said yes. And fast forward, I suddenly realized that there was a lot more out there for career. And so I ended up at that university meeting up with Dr. Robert Barkley and ended up in his bat lab, although that wasn't until after I did a little bit of high school teaching. So I did that for 5 years. And honestly, all I kept thinking about was the time that I'd spent at the University of Calgary working with bats. It was sort of love at first bite. And so after 5 years of teaching, I decided, now I'm going to go check out that research thing. And bats are pretty fascinating. I want to find out more about them.
And one article I read, it actually was love at first bite. It truly was, yes.
So I started working on big brown bats, and they have extremely strong jaws because they're beetle specialists. And I found that one out the hard way when I first tried to handle one, but also pretty fascinated with them because they were banded, the colony that I was working on. And it turns out that some of those bats were older than me at the time when I was actually doing the work. And I think that is what fascinated me, because everything I'd learned in ecology at that point as an undergrad basically pointed to the fact that a small mammal should never live that long. And turns out, you know, bats break all the rules. And this is one of the rules that they break, in that as a small mammal, they are the longest lived and slowest reproducing of all small mammals. They're more like a grizzly bear in terms of longevity, and their generation time is about 12 years. And a grizzly bear is about that, even a little bit less. So it's just fascinating. They're fascinating animals. And I thought, I'm really interested in physiology, actually. And so I thought, how are they doing this? And that's what I dove into graduate work to find out.
So how old can bats be? Like, that's really surprising.
It is surprising, actually. So it varies by species. And honestly, a lot of the species, we don't know what their longevity is. But for the ones that there's been, you know, some documentation using marks, so generally banding bats, for decades now in some areas of the world, they've been able to kind of figure out the longevity in some of these species. And the hibernating species in particular, which was the one, the big brown bat, what I started working on, they can live anywhere from, you know, 20 to 40 years. Myotis species in particular. Now, we in Alberta, through banding that was done by a biologist back in the early 70s, those bats with bands were still being captured for decades later. And we know that a bat there, for example, was at least 39 years old the last time it was sought, it was spotted. So yeah, it's just fascinating how long they can live. Now, the bats that migrate, these are the ones that don't hibernate, and they kind of overwinter in warmer climates and move south. Those ones are thought to have a longevity that's less, and that's because they're not hibernating, because hibernating is really this kind of almost state of dormancy. The cells are really not doing much when they're in hibernation, and that probably gives them this, you know, longevity, because they're not constantly having their cells working.
Right, because they basically a little bit of suspended animation.
A little bit,
and yeah. Extends their lifespan. What are some of the other kind of really unique things about bats in general before we get specific about one?
Oh my gosh, where do I start? Yeah, they're fascinating on so many levels. So I guess, you know, in the same vein of longevity and kind of this dormancy idea. So what's most fascinating about bats, in my opinion, and the reason I did start to study them, I looked initially at their physiology, which sounds kind of boring at first, but it is anything but boring, because here you've got this little animal with these big wings. And this is a huge surface area in which they can lose water and heat. And they're flying. So they have this huge energy demand. So much so, in fact, when they're basically, you know, flying around at night, they have to be eating almost their body weight in insects if they can. Like if there's insects available and the temperatures are warm enough, they're literally trying to eat as much as they can, because the energy from insects is low. But more importantly, their energy costs are so high that if they really just kept a mammalian body temperature like we do, then they would have to eat around the clock. And of course they can't, they're only out at night, and sometimes not the entire night, because insects don't necessarily fly all night on cold nights. So they've got this huge problem. So now what are they gonna do? So evolution has solved that problem for them, and they become more like snakes in that they take on the temperature of their surroundings. So they, if they like wanna save a lot of energy, then their body's gotta go cold. So in the middle of the summer, how are you going to get your body cold? Well, you're going to have to tuck into some rock crack, get deep, deep in somewhere where it's kind of cool, like a little cellar. And so they do that. They'll get in, they'll be really cool, cold, and then they'll let their body temperature just become whatever their surroundings are. So let's say it's a cold spring day. They've got into some place that's, you know, 5 degrees. Let's say it's fall and it's reached like zero. Well, they're going to tuck into a place that's just a little above zero, ideally, so that they don't freeze. But they're going to let their body go really, really low in temperature. And by doing that, they're saving a ton of energy, because their cells really aren't using any energy. And that's called torpor. And so this use of torpor is very, like I said, it's almost like something we see in reptiles, because they basically they just surrender their body temperature and say, I'm going to just take on whatever my surroundings allow, and then that will save me energy. But this brings up a whole other problem for a female who's going to have a pup, because a cold bat can't have a pup. A cold bat can't produce milk for a pup. So that bat's got a huge problem. Female bats have huge problems. They have to stay hot so that they can produce the fetus and then they can nurse. Well, how are they going to do that? Because that takes too much energy. So they go into places that are nice and hot, and then again, they just let the surroundings heat their body. So they take on the same temperature as their surroundings as well, but that temperature has to be hot so that it is literally letting their cells do the work, but not use their own fat to keep that heat high enough so those cells can actually have the chemical reactions that need to happen. So it's really, you know, it all sounds so kind of complicated, but it's very fascinating, you know, that they're even here, really, because like I said, they break the rules. You wouldn't think a small mammal flying using all that energy could possibly make a living given the energy that they need.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about the energy expenditure. That's massive. Like, I mean, we kind of relate that to like a bird, like the hummingbird, maybe, that, you know, we know needs constant energy. I hadn't thought about the bats though, with their flying at night and their food source being
totally. And it's interesting you mentioned the hummingbird, because they do have a lot of similarities in that, yeah, their heart rate can be like hundreds and hundreds of beats per minute when they're flying. But then like when they're in hibernation, for example, it'd be down to like a single beat per minute. So again, this huge range in their physiology is what allows them to exist. And they're just so complicated for that reason.
What's their role, generally speaking, in the ecosystem? Like what's their main purpose?
Well, that they're serving to our ecosystem. It's huge. It's like they're these little unrecognized underdogs because they're out at night. Most people don't even realize they're there, and they are the primary consumer of nighttime insects. So you've got all of these, you know, moths flying around. You've got even the caterpillars that are dangling for these moths. You've got like obviously biting insects, or mosquitoes, and so on. Like you've got all these insects that are out between dusk and dawn, and really it's the bats that are the primary consumers of these. So if we don't have bats, now imagine what could be happening. If these insects don't have this natural check in place, and like I said, bats eat so many insects. You know, they will eat their body weight in insects if they can, if it's a warm night and the insects are still out. So they're important for balance in these ecosystems. So think about like some of the moths, for example. Like there's a nice study from British Columbia from years ago on spruce budworm moth. And so when there's a spruce budworm outbreak, which is a forest pest, bats are responding to that. And as soon as that outbreak happens, you start to record more bats in the area. And then the bats that that are captured during that time show in their guano that they are eating not just the moth, but also the little dangly caterpillars that they're capturing as well. So bats are important. And that's just one example, but bats are important for so many other forest pests, agriculture pests. Think about organic farming. Like organic farmers really depend on natural pest control. They can't just turn to pesticides like the forestry industry does. Right. You know, so bats play a pivotal role for sure in a balanced ecosystem.
Yeah, I know. We love seeing them here in Eastern Ontario in April and May because that's mosquito season. And you go out in the back deck and you see the bats flying around. You're going, yes.
Yes.
Because you know they're taking care of some of them.
Totally. And you know, it's funny because there's two different kind of rumors out there. They each have some legitimacy. One rumor is like bats eat mosquitoes. And then the other rumor is like bats don't eat mosquitoes.
Uh-oh.
And they're both accurate.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I'm not totally wrong then.
No, it's all good. And this is because, and this is kind of one of my pet peeves actually. I do it myself just because I have to, because the public doesn't really know enough about bats, but we all say bats. Okay, so that's like saying ungulates, right? And yet as people, we know an elk is different and has different habitat needs than a caribou, right? Than a deer. We don't associate that so much with bats. We tend to just say bats because they're out at night. People don't know, like a big brown bat. Oh my gosh. So different from a spotted bat or, some of the other Myotis bats. Like there's so much difference between these species, but we don't think about that or necessarily know about that because bats are out at night and we just don't know enough about them. However, as you know, we've learned as bat biologists, the differences between these species are extreme, including their diet. So there are some species that will eat mosquitoes, but there are other species that literally don't even see them. Now I say see with quotations because of course they've got great eyesight, but they're not actually finding prey using their eyes when they're catching insects. They're using echolocation. And so that is ultrasound, that's frequencies above human hearing. And they're going out producing these really small wavelength sounds and they're sending out a pulse of sound and then they're listening for it to echo off or bounce off something to be able to zero in on like, you know, the insect they want to eat, or maybe the tree so they don't run into it. And this is where the interesting differences come, because some species of bats are producing really, really high frequency sounds, which are tiny, tiny little wavelengths. And those little wavelengths will bounce off a little object like a mosquito and come back and let the bat hear it and go, oh, there's some food in front of me. But the bigger bats are producing lower frequency sounds with larger wavelengths that are likely to just go right past a small insect and not bounce off of them. So this is where like a big bat might not even be aware when he's flying around that there's some food in front of them because he's got longer wavelength sounds, which is an advantage in that those travel a lot further So he can fly a lot faster. Where the little bat, their little high frequency don't really actually travel very far, but that's okay because they're adapted for slow flight, right? So there's these kind of extremes, which allows these bats to specialize. So there's some bats that really specialize on bigger insects, moths, you know, some bats literally specialize on just moths, for example. And then other ones are able to eat these tiny little midges and mosquitoes. And so this is why I say they're, you know, it's accurate. Yes, they do eat mosquitoes, but not all bat species do or can. There's even a spotted bat that we have here in British Columbia, a fascinating bat. It actually produces sounds when it's hunting that are actually within our hearing range. So, you know, people in the Okanagan, for example, they might not know when they're out on a warm summer night and they hear a little sound. That's a spotted bat above them out hunting. And they might not know that that's what they're actually hearing, but it's audible. And the reason that they produce these sounds that are really, really low frequency and that humans can hear is because they over evolutionary time have specialized on one particular type of moth. And it's a type of moth, it's a fairly, you know, big moth that has ears on its abdomen. It's little tympanic membranes that allow it to detect bat ultrasound. So all these other bats are out trying to catch this moth. Of course, they never do because the moth picks up on their echolocation, their ultrasonic signals, and literally drops out of the air. And the bat misses the insect. But here's the spotted bat, very stealth, right? It's flying along and it's producing really low frequency sounds that these moths can't hear. And so then that allows them to literally specialize on these moths and gobble them up. So yeah, fascinating.
That's crazy. I'd never heard of the spotted bat before either. We'll be right back.
Dive into purity with North Elevated Water, nature's gift, Elevated. Sourced from pristine BC glaciers, every drop is a sip of freshness. Elevate your hydration. Elevate your day. North Elevated Water. Pure, crisp, unparalleled. Available at drinknorthwater.com.
This spring, embark on an adventure like no other. Join us at the Northern Latitudes Film Festivals, showcasing the spirit of exploration and the thrill of the great outdoors. First up, the world tour stop of the Paddling Film Festival on April 17th. Feel the rush of water and the pulse of the paddle. Then, elevate your spirit with the Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival on May 15th. Experience the highs of adventure right at the heart of downtown Brockville at the Aquatarium. Shows start at 7 p.m. both nights. Tickets are available now at northernlatitudes.ca.
But you mentioned the Myotis bat, which is what kind of got me looking for you to talk about bats. It's on the endangered. Now, this is the northern, correct me if I'm wrong, the northern Myotis bat. That's on the endangered list federally, that you've done quite a bit of work with in BC. Can you describe that guy to me?
Yeah, for sure. Because there's actually quite a few different species of Myotis. Myotis is the genus. Northern Myotis is one of these for sure. Unfortunately, they're the species that's been most affected by white nose syndrome, the fungal disease that's killing bats. And that that disease has been in the kind of the eastern area, the eastern U.S., since 2006, millions of bats have died. And unfortunately, it's this species that's been hit the hardest. While they're hibernating, the fungus literally grows on them like a moldy bat. And then the bat is forced to come out of that dormancy I was talking about, right? So suddenly this bat's kind of warming up, trying to fight off the fungus. And it does that over and over and over again. It's trying to like boost its immune system because an immune system isn't really working when a bat's dormant in hibernation. So over, you know, over the course of the winter, they usually just run out of fat and die. And if they don't, then the fungus has eaten big holes in the wings often, and then they can't fly at the end of the hibernation season anyway. So it's a pretty ugly death. And unfortunately, yeah, this northern myotis has been hit very, very hard by that fungus in the east. Now here in the west, that species is not, it's not found in very many places. In fact, we really just have it in northern British Columbia, over and then a little up into the Yukon. It's also found in northern Alberta. So this species, as far as we know, is still unaffected by white nose syndrome in those two provinces. We have detected the fungus that causes the disease in both British Columbia and Alberta, but no record of the actual disease yet. In other words, we haven't seen bats with these big holes that would suggest that the fungus is actually spreading through the population and affecting them. It's probably just a matter of time. But in the meantime, this species was listed as endangered in Canada because of the mass mortalities that were happening in the east, and knowing that based on genetic records, it looks like the northern myotis is really all one breeding population. So there's no reason to assume that we're not going to see our northerns disappear from the west as well. In the meantime, it's been a race, especially my program has been, you know, really working with Ministry of Environment and Climate Change in British Columbia to try to understand what that species is doing, because we just don't know much about it. And what we do know from some of the other research that's happened is that it seems to have been called an old growth specialist. So when we first started going to look for this species a few years ago, we thought, well, let's go look in old growth and see if we can find the species. So I started over kind of in my area, which is East and West Kootenay area of BC, and starting to kind of move into where we expected them to be. And I was going to patches of remnant old growth and not finding them. So I just kept kind of moving further up, further north to where we basically ran into a big reservoir called Kinbasket Reservoir. And that area was historically a place where that species had been found. But when I got there, I just looked out at a sea of young forest and clear cuts. So it had been heavily logged. And I thought, well, darn, I'm probably not going to find this bat. But at that point, it was actually really late in the day. And my team, we were all like, well, we're on the job. I guess we'll just stick up some mist nets and see if we can capture this species. And so we did, fully expecting we were not going to catch it. But boom, one of them hit our net. And we thought, wow, maybe we're wrong. Like maybe the literature is wrong. Like maybe the species doesn't need old growth, right? Here we are in a very heavily logged area. So we stuck a little transmitter on it. So it's just a little tiny circuit board basically with an antenna, and we glue it on their back with like non-toxic glue that will just fall off after a few days. We send it on its way and we get out our little receivers to track it. The next day we're out there trying to figure out, well, where is this bat? We got a local was kind enough to lend us a boat because we were on the reservoir and we hadn't really planned on catching this bat. So we finally found it, and it was in a little patch of old growth that had, for whatever reason, been missed when the logging had happened. So we caught another one and put a transmitter on and found another little old growth tree patch. So this got us realizing, like, well, first of all, it's probably a good way to find little old growth patches is catch these bats and put transmitters on them. But other than that, the big question now is like, well, how small can these old growth patches be and still have that species there? How far apart can they be? You know, maybe these bats have to just use patches that are within a certain distance of each other. So that was another question we're asking. But the other big one is like, are these bats still just there because they're long lived? Right? Are they even reproducing anymore? Like, right, what level are they reproducing? So that's kind of another question that we've asked now. We're hoping we can get some funding to be able to answer that question. Because if a mammal's living 20, 30, even 40 years, which has been the case with these small myotis bats in particular, maybe those bats are still like just clinging to existence because the logging was done a few decades ago, for example, and they're still there. But it doesn't mean that they're reproducing or successfully reproducing to continue that population. And so there's so much we really need to understand quite quickly about this endangered species, because they, you know, old growth is fast quickly disappearing, unfortunately, from our province.
Why is the old growth in particular so important to them?
Ah, good question. Okay, so this comes down to, again, all these little differences I said exist between the different species of bats. Different species require different types of roosts, and they all need different conditions in which to raise young. And it looks like this northern myotis, what it does is it needs to get into kind of cavities, right? And there'll be like females, a few females, a cluster of them, you know, even up to like 20 or so that will come together and raise their young. And they're doing this basically in kind of undisturbed areas. So there are certain species that are more likely to adapt to being in a disturbed area, like our little brown myotis, for example, which is one of the species that used to commonly occur in people's buildings, in attics, into bat boxes. They're one of the hardiest bat species because it's really hard to disturb them. Whereas some other species like the northern myotis are far more easily disturbed. So they're not going to be hanging out in our urban areas, for example. They're going to be out more in remote areas. And then where do they find these kind of bigger cavities to come together to raise young? And of the right temperature too. Like they're looking for the right temperature because some need it hot and some can't have it too hot, or literally they could die from overheating. So it's this fine line for them. And it just so happens that these old growth cedar in particular, old growth cedar, they, you know, these older cedar trees do get these hollows, mm-hmm. Whereas you don't get those in the younger trees.
And you say the females come together, do they cooperate?
Again, this is a really cool question. Do they help each other raise their young? And
yes.
And the answer is yes, that seems to be the case. So there's several levels of help here. So females just coming together in a cluster will allow each individual bat to save energy, mm-hmm. and to save on water loss. Because if they all hunker together, you know, you can like, right? You know, humans too, if you hunker together, we'll all stay warmer, right? But the bats, we got the big skin wings, right? They lose water very easily too. So again, by having all these bats clustering together, they actually kind of control their microclimate, if you will. They keep it warm, they keep it moist. So that's one thing. But then there's this whole other level of social stuff, which we don't really know. Like we understand in some of the species we've been able to study, like big browns and little browns. And for instance, I did a study on a colony of big browns, and it was amazing to watch how the females would look after each other's pups. So the females would go off and hunt at night, and there'll be, you know, at least one mom that stays back with all the pups as sort of like the pup sitter for the night. But she'll get traded off, you know, another mom will come back and then she'll get to go eat. So there's always this pup sitting going on. We actually, one time when we were capturing the colony to study it, we actually had one mom who tried to flee the roost carrying another mom's pup. And it's probably because she didn't have her own pup and that mom was out foraging already. And so she literally tried to save that pup, even though it wasn't hers. So there's probably this level of helping each other raise each other's pups that we don't understand yet. It's been well documented in vampire bats. They will help each other in amazing ways. They even like regurgitate blood for each other to make sure that if one bat is not able to go out and feed that night, that another bat will come back and regurgitate blood for that other bat. So yeah, the level of social communication, it makes sense. These are long-lived mammals, right? They're very intelligent, and these bonds develop over these long lifespans.
Wow. That's another wow. There's been a lot of wows so far.
That's our wow.
Wow. Like, no, really, that's wow. So what do you guys, like, I mean, obviously we know, for the most part, we know the old growth story. We know that BC's old growth is a minuscule amount of what it used to be. What are you doing to help the bats? Like, obviously you need these trees, but they're not around. So what are you guys doing to actually help them?
Yeah. Well, this is interesting and honestly almost a little bit sad. The state that we're at right now, right? I don't know how else to describe them other than creating fake old growth trees. I mean, we're limited in the amount of effort it takes and the dollar value to make old growth trees, like fake ones, but we're trying it because, you know, we have to try something. So in both the East and the West Kootenai, we have been going into areas and we've been trying it in different ways. Like this is literally set up as an experiment to understand what species use them, what elevation, you know, should we be putting these at for some of these species, and, you know, and just documenting the usefulness of them. Like, are they raising young in them, for example, or are they using them early in the spring or late in the fall? Like, because we're providing a bunch of microclimates like an old growth tree would. So what we're doing is we're taking this old, or this this fake bark. It's a polymer. It's very flexible. It looks like bark. In fact, it was originally designed to use on like movie sets and, you know, and in zoos and stuff, right? So it looks like real bark. And we wrap it around either a pole or a young tree. So young tree has nothing to offer really for bats. Typically, there's just no crevices. But we can create an old growth tree out of that by putting this flex bark around it. And we'll put little chunks of flex bark as well and big ones. And we create all these different microclimates and different cavity sizes to appeal to different species. But essentially, we're hoping then that these bats that need these bigger cavities that would be found in old growth will now be able to use these flex bark or fake bark trees. And this is actually a Copperhead Consulting out of Kentucky is the one that initially decided to use these for bats, and they called it Brandon bark. And it was very successful for them on an endangered species of Myotis they had in the eastern US. And so that's where we got the idea. Let's try this up in Canada. Let's put a bunch of it out and see what species use it. So far we have actually six species that we documented that are using, which is big, because something like a bat box, for example, like typically only two species of bats would use something like that. So we're already seeing a bigger species diversity using them, but we don't understand enough about like, well, how many would we have to create to support like a group of females raising young? Because some of the studies that have been done like in Northern Alberta on the Northern Myotis, for example, has shown like they can use up to 60 trees in a single summer between like, you know, the spring, summer and fall roosts as they raise their young. And so we can't create 60 old growth trees, you know, not at the price that we're and the amount of energy required to do that. So this is a stopgap measure. We're trying to put it in the right places to supplement tree roosts for them. And with the assumption too, that hopefully we can get them into areas where in 20 or 30 years, because that's how long this flex bark is supposed to last. Once we get, you know, into 20 or 30 years from now, hopefully the natural old growth forest will have a chance to have reestablished. But of course, that requires that we don't keep cutting it.
yeah, right. It reminds me of the project to save the spotted owl in BC. You know, it's incredibly sad when you really think about it, of, you know, the time and energy and effort that's being expended to try and save a species. And this reminds me of the same thing. It's like, well, yes, or we could just stop cutting down old growth trees.
That's the thing, right. I mean, you have to actually deal with the root of the problem, and you can put a lot of band-aids on, but those band-aids, they're temporary and they're not necessarily going to work unless we actually deal with the root of the problem.
Yeah. Right. Like you said, they can use 60 different trees over a season, and I assume they need some kind of territory as well, right? Like, I mean, it's not like they're...
And so I'm glad you brought that up, because here in British Columbia, the government is looking at a major shuffle, a paradigm shift as to how we save species and habitat. It's called the Biodiversity and Ecosystem Enhancement or Ecosystem Health Framework. Now, that's just a concept. And so a lot of us organizations like Wildlife Conservation Society Canada, we actually just submitted a letter to the government kind of saying, yes, keep going with this. This is great. And here's you know, some tips and probably things you should be thinking about, because this is major. This is big. If they can actually do it, we might be able to truly reduce the biodiversity loss that is happening in this province. But that's a big if, because we've got competing industries like forestry, which has been, you know, obviously a driving force in the BC economy. So it takes some major policy reform. Right now, what exists to save habitat for bats is pretty bleak. Across the province, it's almost non-existent. In the Kootenays, there's just a special allowance of trial legislation, or trial policy, which allows you to save a feature, a wildlife habitat feature. So it means that one could potentially look at a tree that's kind of big and maybe has some gaping holes. Maybe it's a snag actually already. Maybe it's like it's a dead tree and go, that could be used by bats. Let's not cut that one down. So then they'll call it a wildlife habitat feature, but then they'll log everything all around it. And so, yes, you can see that this does not fit what we know about the biology of bats. You know, maybe they would use that tree, and maybe that tree will be used for, you know, a couple of days here and there in the summer, but that's not enough. I mean, one tree is never enough. So we need something far more comprehensive in this province to be able to truly save habitat. And of course, being able to determine how much old growth, for example, is needed. And that's where this project I was mentioning, I'd like to get rolling on here soon, hopefully, is to understand that question. Like, how much intact old growth would be, you know, kind of ideal for bats to raise their young? We're not ever going to get away with a single tree. That's kind of like, you know, I call it misplaced conservation, because everybody thinks they've done something good for bats. In reality, they haven't, right? So why even bother saving that single tree or single snag? And of course, I feel like bats are a bit of an umbrella, right? We've got so many different species of bats. 3/4 of the ones in BC use trees to roost and raise young. So if we can say we need to keep intact habitat, forest habitat for bats, we're also keeping intact forest for a lot of other species, a lot of biodiversity, right? So I feel like, yeah, it's kind of a win-win in terms of making sure that we can try to keep intact ecosystems in BC, and hopefully the legislation starts to actually reflect that goal.
Thanks, Corey. Corey is the Director of Bat Conservation for the Wildlife Conservation Society of Canada. That's it for this episode of Northern Latitudes. Thanks for joining me for this talk about bats. To learn more about bats and Corey's work, check out the links in the show notes. There were a lot of wow moments in this one for me, and if you listen right through to the end, I've included one more fascinating bit from the outtakes about bats. Our theme music and sound logo created and produced by John Sanfilippo of Soundwise in Kingston. Closing music is called End of Summer by Shimmer. You can find us on all major podcast platforms. Just search for Northern Latitudes and hit subscribe to make sure you never miss an episode. For even more content, including podcasts and my photo gallery, visit the website at northernlatitudes.ca. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future shows, you can reach me at podcast@northernlatitudes.ca. I'm Bill Ault. Thanks for joining me at Northern Latitudes.
Like their ears, like they're screaming at 140 decibels when they echolocate. So, you know, it's like a jet engine, right? Or a smoke detector going off in your ear. And so they have all these really cool ways of making sure they don't damage their own hearing. Like they actually disconnect their little ear bones and put them back together to listen to the echoes. And that's 10 times per second that they repeat that process. Like there's just so many fascinating things about them.
That's wild.